rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, and top of the week to you. Beautiful Monday here, 9:06 on the West Coast, 12:06 on the East Coast, and variations and shades in between. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome to our program, broadcasting live coast to coast, on Sirius, on the web, all over the place. Here, our question for this hour. Did George Bush lie us into attacking Iraq because he wanted to get oil? Did he lie us into attacking Iraq because he wanted to get money for his buddies and for Cheney? Or did he lie us into attacking Iraq for political power? This is the one, this is becoming so obvious to me that what this is all about is that he lied us into Iraq for political power. Americans are beginning to wake up to the fact that Bush lied, but they're still not sure why. This question, why, will determine whether he slips through or goes down in flames. Consider the following newspapers that have nailed him on the lie, but still nobody's talking about why. These newspapers, the Downing Street Minutes, have gotten into the Oregonian, the Salt Lake Tribune, these within the Oregonian front page story, the Salt Lake Tribune, the Commercial Appeals Memphis, the Durham Sunday Herald, the Schenectady Gazette, the Palm Beach Post, the Tennessean, the Houston Chronicle, the Chicago Tribune, Florida Times Union, the Milwaukee Journal, the Peoria Journal Star, the Raleigh News and Observer, the Contra Costa Times in Northern California. Now, of course, that's just a small number of newspapers, given all the newspapers in America. But the fact that a few papers are covering it is a big deal. Knight Ridder says, for example, in their story, the two governments discussed ways to craft an ultimatum to Saddam on UN weapons inspectors that he would be sure to reject, providing an excuse for war. The Pittsburgh newspaper talked about the pressure growing for withdrawal from Iraq. A Florida newspaper asks Americans to ignore the whole thing. The Stars and Stripes covered this. The Stars and Stripes. This is the official newspaper of the Army, of the U.S. military. The Stars and Stripes has served the U.S. military since World War II. And I believe it is now published by the same chain that publishes USA Today. But I could be wrong, so I'm not gonna nail that down, but I believe so. In any case, Stars and Stripes, this from their Pacific edition, quote, several parents of soldiers killed in Iraq visited Capitol Hill on Wednesday to ask for congressional hearings on the Downing Street memo, which one mother calls President Bush's Watergate. Critics say the document, which contains minutes from a meeting in July 2002 between British Prime Minister Tony Blair and top aides, shows that Bush was determined to go to war with Iraq and ignored evidence that showed the country had no weapons of mass destruction. That from the Stars and Stripes. Now, the right-wingers are already, you know, chiming in full tilt boogie here. They're coming in every way, as loud as they can, as much as they can. Oh, there must be a forgery here. We got to do to the Times what we did to Dan Rather. Michael Smith, the reporter for the London Times, is the guy that the conservative strategy is always kill the messenger. Joe Wilson comes out and says, "Hey, there's no uranium coming out of Niger that's going to Iraq." What do? They go after him. They can't find anything to get him on. They take out his wife. Dan Rather comes out and says, "Hey, George W. Bush got in the champagne unit of the National Guard. You know, blah, 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 blah. Should have served. He didn't. He was able to avoid service." And he actually had, you know, the witness. He had the guy who made the phone call, who got, you know, got Bush leapfrogged ahead of a whole bunch of other people, you know, several hundred, 235, as I recall, other people, so that he could get in before the draft got him, because his draft number was coming up. And Dan Rather has this guy on TV saying, you know, to this day I feel guilty, because I suspect that somebody else who was in line and should have, you know, gotten out of Vietnam by serving in the champagne unit of the Air National Guard, instead had to go to Vietnam and may have died. And somebody might have died because of something that this fellow did. And he's on TV talking about how he felt guilty about it. I mean, it was absolutely unambiguous that Bush used political influence of his father to get into the National Guard, that he didn't show up for service, that he went AWOL. Absolutely unambiguous. A pile of evidence, and nobody is disputing those facts to this day. All right, nobody's coming out and saying, no, those facts aren't true. Instead, what they said is, oh, one of the pieces of paper that Dan Rather cited may not be an accurate original. It might be a forgery. One of the pieces of paper that he cited. And they've blown that one piece of paper, or those three or four pieces, you know, whatever it is, that one set of documents, which were anonymously given to the reporter for CBS. Now, this so much reminds me of Karl Rove tapping his own office, wiretapping his own office, when his candidate was running for governor of Texas many years ago and was falling behind in the polls. And Rove then discovers a bug behind a picture in his office. Turns out that the bug had a battery in it, which only had a 30-minute lifespan and had only been in use for 10 minutes, and Rove had been in the office more than an hour. Now, you go figure that one, right? But he discovers the bug, calls the FBI, calls the state police. They come in, he calls a press conference. I've been bugged! And all of a sudden, the whole debate has changed. Now, I am convinced that if the phony memos, that if the memos that Dan Rather had were phony, that they came from the office of Karl Rove. Because this is just absolutely consistent with the way he does things, with what he's done in the past. You know, it just makes perfect sense to me. So here's where it gets really interesting. The Times of London published the first memo, the Downing Street minutes, the minutes of the meeting. They published that this is absolutely unimpeachable. This was leaked by a member of parliament. This is solid. And this was the one that said that the Bush administration was fixing intelligence to match the policy. The policy being that we were going to attack Iraq. And then a week or two later, actually a month or so later, a new set of documents appears that seems to corroborate the original, but goes a little farther. These are the Downing Street memos. And Michael Smith, the reporter who did the original story, he's given these by an anonymous source, and he publishes them. And today, now, the same right-wing blogs that noticed the typographical error within 20 minutes of the time that Dan Rather put those documents up on the screen. Now, how would you do that if you weren't involved in getting those documents there in the first place? It was the first question that popped into my mind. The same right-wing blogs are now out there jumping up and down, yelling and screaming, saying, these memos are phonies. So, you know, did Michael Smith get fed a second set of phony memos? Are they trying to do the same thing they did to Dan Rather with the Bush National Guard story and bring down the story by slipping some bad information into it? Or are they simply hoping that if they yell and scream enough, it'll stick? Well, whatever they're doing, the reality is that Bush lied. I mean, here we had George W. Bush at the time that we know now from the original Downing Street memo, the one that is nobody is challenging its authenticity. It's been confirmed by Downing Street. At the time that he was fixing the policy, the intelligence around the policy, at the time that we know he had already decided to go to war, George Bush on October 1st, before the 2002 elections, October 1st, 2002, this is when they were carefully using this as a way of, you know, the Democrats were very wary about this. Is he going to use this power, this resolution, is he going to use this to take us into war? And he's like, no, we'd never do that. And then any Democrat who voted against it got trashed in the elections. They used this to take back the Senate in 2002. So here we are, 1 month before the election of 2002, 6 months after they'd already decided that they were going to invade Iraq, George Bush lying to the American people.
Going to war with Iraq. Of course, I hadn't made up my mind we're going to war with Iraq.
Of course, I haven't made up my mind. And here another one, and thanks, to, by the way, to the folks in our chat room and to Sue for pulling these things together. Here, George Bush on the 11th, excuse me, on November 7th. This just after the election of 2002, the Republicans successfully pulled it off because of Bush's lies. George Bush.
Hopefully we can do this peacefully. Don't get me wrong. And if the world were to collectively come together to do so and to put pressure on Saddam Hussein and convince him to disarm, there's a chance he may decide to do that. And war is not my first choice. Don't get, you know, it's my last choice.
And we know now that that was just a bald-faced lie. That he'd been planning on this war since 1999. We'll get to that in a minute. Here's Bush again. This on the 4th of December 2002.
This is our attempt to work with the world community to create peace. And the best way for peace is for Mr. Saddam Hussein to disarm. It's up to him to make his decision.
And again on December 31st, the end of the year of 2002, as he's still preparing for war and telling us that he's not.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you. And I hope this can be done peacefully.
Yeah, and that's not what he hoped. He was lying to us. And here we are in 2003. Now we're up to March 6th. Of 2003, George Bush.
I want to remind you that it's his choice to make as to whether or not we go to war. It's Saddam's choice. He's the person that can make the choice of war and peace.
Now, what we know now is that for 6 months, they had been bombing the bejesus out of him, trying to provoke him into some sort of defensive response that could then be used as an excuse to go to war. Another lie. George Bush on March 8th.
We're doing everything we can to avoid war in Iraq. But if Saddam Hussein does not disarm peacefully, he will be disarmed by force.
And he did disarm peacefully. He had no weapons. We found nothing. There's no weapons of mass destruction there. His army was, you know, ragtag tatters. His Air Force was completely gone. He had no Navy. There was nothing. There was nothing. I mean, you know, look at it. We took the country in a couple of weeks. It was not a big deal. George Bush, another lie here. This on the 31st, let's see, 2003. This was in 2003, March 17th, excuse me, March 17th of 2003.
Should Saddam Hussein choose confrontation, the American people can know that every measure has been taken to avoid war. And every measure will be taken to win it.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, here's a serial lies about death. About war, about the something that led to the death now of 1,700 Americans. Every single one of them as alive as you and me and as desirous of continuing living as you and me until George Bush put them in harm's way. 20 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Third time I've said that. I'll probably say it three more times. See, in my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in, to kind of catapult the propaganda.
You gave them the old razzle dazzle.
Catapulting the propaganda.
You gave them an act with lots of flash in it, made them believe you were compassionate, gave them the old hocus pocus. Yeah, misdirected them with 9/11 and Saddam Hussein. You played them both right to perfection, despite the fact there's no connection. You razzle-dazzled them, let those blue states complain.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Yes. Robin Neblett, Executive Vice President, Chief Operating Officer for the Center for Strategic and International Studies, claimed that, quote, fixed around in British English means bolted on rather than altered to fit the policy, end quote. So this was the first attempt to spin this thing. The cons saying, No. We were trying to fix the intelligence to the policy. And what that means is that we were trying to connect the two. We were trying to bolt it on. In an exclusive interview with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice on June 15th, this is from MediaMatters.org. On the June 15th edition of MSNBC's Hardball with Chris Matthews, Rice eagerly agreed with Matthews' suggestion. This guy's getting more right-wing every day. That in Britain, the word fixed really means just put things together. And in fact, the Weekly Standard, Todd Lundberg, the contributing editor of that publication, wrote, quote, fix here is clearly meant in its traditional sense, in the sort of English spoken by Oxbridge dons and MI6 directors, to make fast, to set in order, to arrange. And a whole bunch of the other conservatives on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, National Review editor Rich Lowry, saying the same thing. Online Review, National Review Online, contributing editor James Robbins, saying this, you know, fixed, you know, they're all trying to change the meaning of the phrase. But, says Media Matters, British sources, actual Brits, contradict these claims. In a British Broadcasting Corporation documentary from March, which quoted the Downing Street memo more than a month before the Sunday Times published it, BBC reporter John Ware explained, quote, now here's BBC, by fixed, the MI6 chief meant that the Americans were trawling for evidence to reinforce their claim that Saddam was a threat. End quote. The headline of a Sunday Times preview of the documentary. This is the headline of the newspaper, the Sunday Times of London. Quote, MI6 chief told PM, told Prime Minister, Americans fixed case for war. End quote. Also makes it clear how the British understood the word fixed. Similarly, Sunday Times reporter Michael Smith, who first disclosed the memo on May 1st, ridiculed the notion that fixed has a different meaning in Britain. In a Washington Post online chat, he said, there are a number of people asking about fixed and its meaning. This is a real joke. I do not know anyone in the UK who took it to mean anything other than in fixed, as in fixed a race, fixed an election, fixed the intelligence. If you fix something, you make it the way you want it. The intelligence was fixed, and as for the reports that said this was one British official. Please, this is the head of MI6. How much authority do you want the man to have? He'd just been to Washington. He had just talked to George Tenet. He said the intelligence and facts are being fixed around the policy. That translates in clearer terms as the intelligence was being cooked to match what the administration wanted it to say to justify invading Iraq. Fixed means the same here as it does there in the United States. So that didn't work. That didn't work. You know, they tried to get that out. You know, yeah, he's just fixed the intelligence. But fixed doesn't mean what you think it means. That didn't work. So now the cons are saying, oh, and by the way, that second set of memos that somehow showed up over there in England, those aren't real. Those aren't real. It's the Dan Rather story all over again. And that, I guarantee you, that's what the right-wingers will be bloviating about ad nauseum all day on the Reich Wing talk shows. Bet on it. 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harbin.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I can't keep up, and I can't back down. I've been losing so much time.
And welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. Your light at the end of the tunnel at Talk Radio, the No Boring Zone. Well, here's an interesting little tidbit. You know, Dana Milbank, the Washington Post reporter who wrote the only story in the Washington Post about John Conyers' hearings last week, in which he ridiculed John Conyers and his merry band, which included a woman whose son died in Iraq. Dana Milbank, White House reporter for the Washington Post, is a member of the Skull and Bones Society. Isn't that interesting? I've got the list here, and I'm assuming it's a legitimate list. Could it be that a lot of folks just didn't find that all that funny. This is just a humorous thing. I mean, Dana Milbank did. Apparently, a lot of the reporters who cover the White House did. You'll recall back on March 24th of last year, the Radio and TV Correspondents Association, at that point, 500 Americans had already died. 1,500 people showed up for this surf and turf dinner, black tie dinner. Greg Mitchell writes about it in Editor and Publisher. Editor and Publisher, a publication for the industry, right? Writes about it. He says, that night in the middle of his stand-up routine before the perhaps tipsy journalists, Bush showed on a screen behind him some candid on-the-job photos of himself. One featured him gazing out a window as Bush narrated, smiling, those weapons of mass destruction have got to be here somewhere. According to the transcript, this was greeted with laughter and applause. A few seconds later, he was shown looking under papers, behind drapes, and even under his desk with this narration. Nope, no weapons over there. Met with more laughter and applause. And then, maybe under here? Just laughter this time. Still searching, he finally settles for a photo revealing the skull and bone secret signal. Dana Milbank, in his column on Friday, declared that the House Democrats, quote, took a trip to the land of make-believe, end quote, in pretending that the basement conference room was actually a real hearing room. This from editor and publisher Greg Mitchell's piece. Even importing a few American flags to make it look more official. Oddly, he seemed less interested in the far more serious make-believe that inspired the basement session, the administration's fake case for WMDs in Iraq that has already led to the deaths of over 1,700 Americans and tens of thousands of Iraqis. No, Milbank used the valuable real estate of the Post, its only coverage of the event, to mock Representative John Conyers, who arranged the meeting, and his, quote, hearty band of playmates, end quote. This fun-loving, quote, band, end quote, included a mother who had lost her son in Iraq. I mean, just how bad does it have to get? How bad does it have to get? And then Bush yesterday, in his weekly radio address. We went to war because we were attacked. Say what? We went to war because we were attacked? Well, I suppose you could argue that about Afghanistan, but what does that have to do with Iraq? I mean, Osama bin Laden was in Afghanistan. He was running training camps out of Afghanistan. Osama bin Laden hated Saddam Hussein. He tried to kill him twice. Osama bin Laden tried to organize an army after the Afghan campaign was over and was successful. The U.S. funding Osama bin Laden and helping him set up al-Qaeda to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. Remember that? And he was successful, and he went back to Saudi Arabia, the conquering hero, and said, okay, next, we drove out those evil Russians, those godless communists, and now we've got a godless dictator on our border, he said. The godless dictator on our border, of course, Saddam Hussein, on the border of Saudi Arabia. Iraq was a secular state. It was intolerable to Osama bin Laden. He wanted to install a Taliban in Iraq. And so he pulls together an army of his own and starts heading for the Iraqi border, and the Saudis stop him. They arrest him. They deport him to Sudan. They tell him he can't be in his own country anymore if he's going to play. You know, if you're not going to play well with others, you can't play in this region. And Osama goes nuts. He's like, hey, you guys, you're in the pocket of the Americans. You're pumping oil for them cheap. You're letting them put American soldiers on the bases here ever since 91 when George Bush Sr. asked if you could put them there for the Gulf War invasion of Iraq, and they're still there. And you got men who are drinking alcohol and women who are walking around without veils and driving cars and voting? You can't have this. And he said to the United States, if you guys don't remove your forces, remove your soldiers from Saudi Arabia, and if you don't stop that regime from pumping cheap oil, you know, let the price go up to $200 a barrel. Let it go up to what it really should be, reflect its real value. If you don't do these things, then Osama bin Laden said he was going to attack us. This like 8 years ago. And, you know, sure enough. But what does that have to do with Iraq? Other than the fact that once he tried to attack Iraq, too. I don't get it. I am completely baffled. I do get it. Here's what's going on. George Bush lied us into this war in order, for a very, very simple reason, got us into this war because he wanted to gain political power. That's what it was all about. It was all about political power, pure and simple. It was about taking control of the Senate in 2002, taking control of the White House in 2004. And, you know, had it been about, gee, we need to get our oil supplies to secure the nation, or had it been about, you know, gee, we really need to control that region, we need to help Israel, you know, something like that. And I think a lot of people in the Washington press corps think that that's really what it was about. Had it been about those things, then you could say, well, you know, it was a lie, but it was a lie in the national interest. And it's a war that didn't turn out the way that we wanted it to, but it was a war in the national interest, sort of like Vietnam. You know, Vietnam, we had to stop those nasty communists somehow. If we didn't, you know, the domino theory, they were going to take out Southeast Asia. We screwed up in the way that we did it, but, you know, at least our intentions were noble in the first place. That's the story that was bought by many Americans. But now it turns out that's not, none of those were the reasons why Bush invaded Iraq. And it had nothing to do with the excuse that Condoleezza Rice is putting out that, you know, that they were stupid. They had bad intelligence. That the whole world thought Saddam had weapons. Sorry, the whole world didn't think Saddam had weapons. Not at all. Not even remotely. The whole world thought he didn't have weapons. That's why the whole world didn't invade. That's why the UN never passed a resolution authorizing the invasion. That's why Bush had to go in before the weapons inspectors were finished. Because it was obvious everybody was coming to the conclusion, there's no weapons there. There's nothing there. He doesn't represent a threat. This was a war for political power. And therefore, it was a lie for political power. When Bill Clinton lied about sex in order to retain political power, Congress decided that was an impeachable offense. When Richard Nixon lied about Watergate in order to maintain political power, Congress decided that was an impeachable offense. George Bush has lied about war in order to maintain and keep political power, in order to get and keep political power. Quite simply, is that an impeachable offense? In my opinion, clearly, it is an impeachable offense. Clearly. And here we have Mickey Herskowitz, the guy that Bush hired to write his autobiography, a book called A Charge to Keep, My Journey to the White House. Herskowitz wrote the first couple of drafts, and then Bush brought in somebody else. He told Russell Baker, who wrote the article about this, Russ Baker. Well, I'll quote you. This is the quote. This is Herskowitz talking to Baker. Quote, he's talking about George W. Bush. He was thinking about invading Iraq in 1999. This was during the early stages of his presidential campaign. It was on his mind. He said to me, one of the keys to being seen, now this is Bush speaking, one of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as a commander-in-chief. And he said, my father had all his political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait and he wasted it. He said, if I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a very successful presidency. What did he want to get passed? We know that Bush wanted to massively cut taxes on his corporate sponsors and people like himself with substantial inherited fortunes. He wanted to weaken government protections on the environment, on children, the poor, the elderly, the ozone layer, our nation's forests. He wanted his oil rig and mining interest friends to have more access to public lands. We know he wanted to roll back the New Deal by stripping the American workplace, particularly government and schools, of unions, rolling back socialist unemployment and Social Security programs, eliminating the SEC and tort restraints on predatory corporate behavior. He'd even campaigned on this platform, particularly Social Security privatization, back in 78 when he unsuccessfully ran for Congress from Texas. We know he wanted to increase the police power of the federal government, gut the First and Fourth Amendments, and thus create a safe and orderly nation of people under constant surveillance who never questioned those in power. We know he wanted to give billions of tax dollars to churches he approved of and bring their leaders into the halls of government. He wanted to pass laws incorporating religious dogma about when human life begins, what is appropriate sexuality, and free churches to use tax-exempt dollars to influence politics. This is a huge agenda. He wanted to remake the face of politics in America. He'd been talking about it since the 70s. And he knew that the only way to do it was to have what he called political capital. And where was he going to get that political capital? Well, as he told Mickey Herskowitz, he was going to get it by invading Iraq. He came right out and said it in 99. And he did it. As he says, he's a guy who does what he's going to say he's going to. He did it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Sam in Daytona Beach, Florida, I assume that is on the line. Hey, Sam, what's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom. Hey, listen, I just tuned in here about half an hour ago. Wanted to know if you saw the report about the numbers for the fatalities in Iraq being grossly underestimated because of the technicality of them being flown out and then dying in transit and in other foreign bases.
Yeah, it's 5-6 months ago that was reported, and there was a big deal about it made in the, not so much in the mainstream media, but some of it filtered
General
in.
Jim Lampley did a great story on it on the Huffington Post. Sorry for the plug there.
No, it's good.
Just to cite my source, I saw it today,
mm-hmm.
and according to some of his unnamed inside sources, very similar to what Cy Hirsch and so forth are typical for citing, they're saying it's more like 9,000 true fatalities as a result of that war. And
wow.
It's just like you say, it's not in the mainstream media, but God,
yeah.
People are so involved in the numbers.
I hope somebody tracks it down, Sam. I noticed the other day that there was, you know, when they list, you know, how people died and where and when they died, that one of the people, this was like last week, one of the people, I just happened to notice in the paper, one of the people who was listed as having died was listed as having died at the hospital in Germany. So
right.
That caused me to think, well, they're not hiding all of them. I don't know. Maybe they just toss in one every now and then. I just, you know, honestly, I don't think any of us know the truth. But, Sam, I appreciate you raising the issue. It's an important one. It's one that needs to be raised more often. Tomas in Grand Rapids. Hey, Tomas.
Hey, it's your compassionate conservative cousin here. But
there you go.
Listen, you know, I could talk about the memos there, but I'm just wondering, I can listen to Limbaugh and yourself simultaneously on two little radios I have, okay, in Grand Rapids.
Right. All right.
You're both talking about the same thing. It's like you're both debating.
Yeah.
It's like you both know what the other guy's going to say. When you were saying, and they're going to say that the second memos are false like the Texas, that's what Limbaugh was saying at the same time.
Well, thank you, Tomas. I appreciate
okay.
it. Thank you for validating my wisdom. Gene in Hillsborough on the line. Hey, Hillsborough, where?
Oregon.
Oh, Oregon. Hey, Gene, what's up?
I'm just with you. Okay, this is what I did on my live journal because I put in there about the Downing Street papers. I went and I switched from memo to minute so that when people read that it'll say minutes, and they'll look for the minutes and not the memo, so that any right winger that comes by and wants to trash me. I can say, are you talking about the minutes of the memo?
Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, the average American won't know the difference. And if they can discredit the memo, and I mean, there's no way they're going to discredit the minutes because those are provided by a member of parliament and they've been acknowledged by the Blair government. But the memo, you know, has been the only thing the government said is that it looked authentic. Well, that's what they said about the Killian memos with the 60 Minutes. And so you can bet that the cons are going to be all over that and trying again to deflect attention away from the real issue. Which is why did Bush lie us into this war? And and you've got, you know, Condoleezza Rice on TV saying, well, he lied us into this war because he was ignorant, because we were uninformed, because our intelligence had failed. And everybody else agreed with us on that, which, of course, is not true. And then you've got the pundits, the Dana Milbanks of the world, saying, implicitly suggesting, well, he lied us into the war because there was some greater good, you know. And it turns out he lied us into the war because he wanted to get political power. So it's just that simple. Gene, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program, 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartmann.
Now you don't know my name, but you know who I am. I'm your everyday work hard, play hard, raise kids and pray hard, common man.
And we're going to take our country back.
I love this land. That's why I'm taking my country back.
And welcome back.
My family and my church and flag. I'm taking my country back.
That's what we got to do, my friends. We got to take our country back. There you go. Take it back from this guy who drove us into Iraq. Why did he lie us into Iraq? Marvin in Temple, Texas, on the line. Hey, Marvin, what's up?
Oh, not a whole lot. It's just you were saying that he lied it for political reasons, for political gain. I think that was probably one of the reasons, but there's so many reasons that he could have used. I doubt that it was any one reason.
Well, I'm suggesting that that's the overarching reason, because in order to do everything else, you have to have the political power.
Okay, well, I don't know. Maybe he thought there was a vacuum left when the USSR came apart, because they had such wonderful success spreading their communism at the end of a gun. Maybe he thought we could have democracy.
Well, that's the point I make. And there's a piece that I wrote that's on commondreams.org today, you know, in which I just, you know, I point out the logic that the neocons are using of empire has always led to the destruction of the empires. It bleeds them dry. It absolutely bleeds them dry. And you know, and that's the stuff that what boggles my mind is that's the stuff that the elite reporters, we're talking about the people who are inside the White House, the people with the big salaries, the people who are sucking up to the administration because they're scared to death that they'll lose access, that, you know, the Dana Milbanks of the world, that the elite reporters, that's the story that they seem to be buying. That, you know, in order to maintain a safe America, we must project force around the world, that kind of thing. And it's a very, very, very destructive story. It's a story that'll just destroy the United States. I mean, it leads to empire, and it leads to the end of empire. Marvin, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. We'll continue this on the other side of the news. Folks who are on hold, we'll be back with you. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program. The place where smart people get their news. The radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program, check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, live 365's American FM, and whiterosesociety.org. Where you can also find archives of this program and a podcast of this program, as well as on CRN Digital in 29 states on cable systems. Welcome back to our program. Bush lied, and Americans died. And Iraqis died. And continue to die. But politically, at least so far, it's worked out well for Bush. Here's what George Bush told the man he hired to write his biography, his autobiography. A Charge to Keep, a book now in the bookstands, in the bookstores. The original guy who was hired to write this book, Mickey Herskowitz, did a series of 20-some-odd interviews with George W. Bush. And you know, then it became obvious that Herskowitz wasn't quite, you know, spinning things the way the Bush family wanted, and so they hired somebody else to finish the book. It wasn't quite the fluff piece that they wanted. And he was interviewed by Russell Baker. Russell Baker, the writer whose work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, you know, on and on the list goes. Russ Baker, in October of 2004, printed an article in which he quoted Mickey Herskowitz about Mickey's discussions with George W. Bush when he was writing the autobiography for George, when he was ghostwriting George W. Bush's autobiography. And here's what Herskowitz told Russ Baker. Quote, he was thinking about invading Iraq in 1999. It was on his mind. He, Bush, said to me, one of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as a commander-in-chief. And he said, my father had all his political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait and he wasted it. He said, if I have a chance to invade, you get this, in 1999 he said this, if I have a chance to invade, if I had that much political capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency. End quote. Bush lied us into this war for political power, pure and simple. It was a lie of political expediency, with a war resolution carefully timed just before the 2002 elections to help the Republicans take back the Senate. It was echoed and amplified and repeated over and over again to help him and other Republicans get elected in 2004. It was not a war for oil. Cheap oil was a useful secondary benefit. But if you don't control the House, the Senate, and the White House, you can't get that oil. You can't have your war. It wasn't a war against terrorism. That was just a convenient excuse. There were no terrorists in Iraq. And for that matter, by and large, there aren't today. There are insurgents. There are Iraqis who are trying to take their country back from us. Oh, there's foreign fighters over there. Well, why haven't we seen even one on TV? How many Saudis have been captured in Iraq so far? It wasn't a war to enrich Bush's and Cheney's cronies. Those were just pleasant byproducts. It wasn't a war to show Poppy Bush that Junior was more than a man, more of a man than him. That was just a personal bonus for W. It was, pure and simple, well-planned, years in advance, a war to solidify Bush and the Republican Party's political capital, and that's why they are now going to close ranks behind him. They are trying to, on the one hand, convince us all that, if he did lie, it was because he had bad intelligence. George Tenet lied to him. This is what Condi Rice is running around saying. The whole world thought they had WMDs. No, sorry, not true. But that's the big lie that's worked up till now for the average, you know, for some people. And then the second lie that they're going to try, we're fighting them over there so that we won't have to fight them here. This is what Bush said this weekend in his radio address. And just what? Do you think the Iraqi, if we pull out of Iraq, all those Iraqis who are trying to take their country back from us are going to come over here? I don't think so. What, are they going to get flying camels? Like, you know, one of our callers said earlier? I don't think so. And Bush again, this weekend, he said, we were attacked and we had to go to war. Well, we were not attacked by Iraq. He's going to have a major address, in the next week or so on Iraq. I guarantee you, these are the primary talking points that are going to be put forward. They have got Frank Luntz working overtime right now, fine-tuning the talking points. You know, what is it that we can say that will convince the average American that there's some reason for this war beyond political power? Do not pull that curtain back. Do not let them see that man behind the curtain, because that man behind the curtain is the Achilles heel of the whole thing. This is what will bring down George W. Bush, is when the press figures out that what they've assumed was the reason he invaded wasn't even the case. The elite press in America, the reporters, the six and seven figure salary reporters in America who've been giving Bush a free ride on this, a pass on this, have been doing so because, yeah, they knew he lied us into the war. I mean, come on, they pay attention to the news for a living. They knew he lied us into the war. But they've been assuming that he did it because it was the best thing for America. Because in order to prevent throwing us into a depression, we need to secure our oil supplies in the Middle East. Well, come on, we can buy oil from them. It doesn't matter who's running those countries. We've been buying oil from dictators for decades. For a century. Well, maybe it's to stop the Chinese from getting the oil first. Well, you want to stop the Chinese from needing the oil, stop shipping our jobs to them. I mean, it's to establish a footprint in the Middle East to protect Israel. Come on, Israel has one of the most robust militaries in the world. They're one of a handful of nuclear nations. No, it's not any of those reasons that have been bought by the elite media. The corporate media, the well-paid, you know, good haircut guys, no. And women, no. It was pure and simple to get and keep political power, to get Republicans elected to office. That's why this war happened. And when Richard Nixon lied about Watergate to get and keep power, he was impeached. And when Bill Clinton lied about having sex with Monica Lewinsky to maintain his power, he was impeached. You decide. What's the greater crime? Lying to the American people in the world about a break-in in your opponent's office? About having sex in the White House? Or about invading a sovereign nation that represents no threat to you and causing the death of 100,000 civilians and somewhere between 1,700 and 9,000 of your own citizens? Which is the bigger crime? Who should be the most notorious in the annals of history? 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Dave in Michigan on the line. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Yep. The assumption. Hello?
Yeah, sorry about that. I had to turn you up there. Go ahead.
You may be right about the assumption of the media and going along with Bush, but you want to know the real reason why he's had such a free ride and it's worked out for him? It's because of a lack of dissent and a fear of dissent. It's the big mob Democrats that keep putting their foot in their mouths, and I'm not talking about Howard Dean or Dick Durbin or Nancy Pelosi or Bernie Sanders. I'm talking about Joe Biden's of the world, the guys that apologize for the Howard Deans, the guys that are the media's go-to guy that know exactly what the media, that the media knows exactly, are going to say exactly what they want to say. People should be reminded that Joe Biden and Dick Dodd or Dodd from Connecticut and Chris Dodd and Pat Leahy from Vermont, these are part of the old guard. These are the guys that voted for Clarence Thomas. These are the guys that refused to listen to Anita Hill when she was shining a light in their face saying, wake up.
Yeah.
And they went along with this.
I don't disagree with you, Dave, but here, let me provide you with a larger context. Dick Durbin, last week pointed out that when he read an FBI report that talked about a fellow down in Guantanamo Bay who had been chained, I believe it was Guantanamo, it might have been...
Yes, it was Guantanamo.
Yeah, okay, down in Guantanamo, who had been chained in the fetal position, his ankles to his wrists, on a concrete floor, naked, for 24 hours, for more than at least 24 hours, covered in his own feces, pulled his hair out during the night. He was in a freezing cell, the air conditioning on full blast, and Dick Durbin said... This is the kind of interrogation technique you would expect in Nazi Germany and the Soviet Gulag or in Pol Pot's Cambodia, which it is. Dick Durbin said that. Now, let me finish this thought here. Dick Durbin said that, and the Republicans jumped all over him, and a couple of days ago, Dick Durbin retracted, you know, apologized, basically, for that. And everybody's saying he's spineless. And, yes, Joe Biden, you know, the go-to guy for the media, he wants to run for president. That's what Joe Biden's all about. Joe Biden was on TV, you know, this weekend with Tim Russert going, well, you know, Dick Durbin has apologized. Now, why is it that Durbin got attacked and had to apologize, and James Inhofe, the Republican chairman of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, calls the EPA staff a Gestapo bureaucracy, and he doesn't have to apologize? Why is it that last October, when Senator Jeff Sessions, the Republican from Alabama, said of people who work on stem cell research, quote, we have certainly seen all the rejection of Nazi Germany's abuses of science. As a society and nation, there ought to be a limit on what we can allow or should allow. In other words, he said people who work on stem cells are Nazis. Why didn't Jeff Sessions apologize? Senator Phil Graham of Texas, former senator, he's talking about a tax plan, Bill Clinton's tax plan, you know, tax increase on millionaires and billionaires. And he says, and I quote, now, forgive me, but that is right out of Nazi Germany. I don't understand why all of a sudden we are passing laws that sound as if they are right out of Nazi Germany. End quote. He's talking about balancing the budget. Even more shockingly, Representative Tom Cole, Republican from Oklahoma, had the audacity to tell local Oklahoma Republicans last March that a vote against President Bush's reelection was the same thing as supporting Adolf Hitler during World War II. And then you get Representative Peter King, Republican from New York, the guy who just before the election in 2004 said, now it's all that's left is up to the voting machines, and we've taken care of them, too. And he says, he's talking about abortion. He says, that, Mr. Speaker, is a modern-day equivalent of the Nazi prisoner guard saying I was just following orders. It was all legal in Nazi Germany at the time. Okay, so here we have five Republicans who have made Nazi analogies to Democrats, to people who want to raise taxes, to the Environmental Protection Agency. You had Rod Page recently calling the teachers union terrorists. Why did they not apologize? Now, let me answer my own question. The media did not go after any of these guys.
That's right.
The media relentlessly went after Dick Durbin. I'm telling you, it is not so much that we've got spineless Democrats. It's that if a Democrat steps out of line, the New York media, the Washington, D.C. media, the L.A. media, the big-time, big corporate media, they go after them with an absolute vengeance, whereas if a Republican says something outrageous like this, they get a pass.
I think in part it's because the Dick Durbins and again the Howard Deans and the guy there from Vermont, your friend that's on Bernie Sanders, these guys are real people.
Yeah.
They have real original thoughts, and real original thoughts scare the hell out of the media because they don't know how to react to what's real. They sure as hell scare the hell out of the Republicans and Bush's boy up there. You know, I mean, they have no idea how to relate and react to this type of. Uniqueness.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Dave. I thank you for calling. I agree with you about Howard Dean and Bernie Sanders. They are real people, and they're doing a great job. And, you know, God bless them. Let them say even more. At the bottom of the hour, by the way, we're going to take a few more of your calls after this break. At the bottom of the hour, a fascinating story about sex education in Texas, of all things. 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
So long, honeybee, where I'm bound, I can't tell.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, toll-free coast-to-coast. Kevin in Tampa, Florida on the line. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's been a while since I spoke with you. I got two real quick comments, and I'll hang up. First, on the Washington Post coverage of John Conyers last week.
Yeah, Dana Milbank's piece. Dana Milbank's
yeah.
the...
Conyers wrote a letter to the editor of the Post yesterday.
Yeah, actually...
And he blasted him item by item.
Yeah, actually, he wrote the letter. He wrote the letter on Friday, and it was posted on Common Dreams on Saturday. In fact, I forwarded it to Common Dreams. So, yes, I'm familiar with that.
Okay, and the second comment about those the six follow-up documents in London.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference between that and the previous fiasco with CBS. These are not 25-year-old documents. These are brand new. The Times of London approached the British government about them. The British government refused to deny or accept them. And the people who wrote them, supposedly, are still alive, and not one of them has said that they didn't write it.
Right, nor have any of them come forward in the press and said that they did write it. I guarantee you, Kevin, the right-wingers are going to spin this thing as hard as they can about, oh, maybe these documents are phony, you know, because what they are terrified of, and they are truly terrified of it, because this is the impeachable offense, what they are terrified of is that people will come to the conclusion that Bush lied us into this war for political purposes. And Blair is terrified of that, too, by the way, which causes me to think that, you know, this cover-up could actually, it might even be successful, because it's going to have to come out of the UK.
There is a difference, though. The UK reporters are not wussies like the American reporters.
Yeah, by and large. But still, you know, power is power and a cover-up's a cover-up. Kevin, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, you know, we'll see. You know, time will tell how this thing plays out. I'm just not terribly optimistic. Scott in San Diego, California. Hey, Scott, what's up? Oh, Scott's apparently not there. Dave in Eureka, California. Hey, Dave.
Hi, Tom. I know that you have been very reluctant to arrive at certain conclusions. But, you know, whether their motivation was to get neocons elected, to hang on to political power, or to shift billions of tax dollars to Halliburton and Bechtel, whatever, their motives were very, very criminal in nature. I'd say that our country has been stolen by the most serious pathological criminals we could have hoped for.
And you say that as a mental health professional?
I'm saying that. I would say that's true of all the psychopathic lies we've had from Cheney, from Bush, from Condoleezza, from Rove. They plotted this out.
Well, clearly, I mean, if Mickey Herskowitz is right, and there's, you know, he seems fairly solid, Bush was talking about this in 99. If Paul O'Neill is right, Bush was talking about this the first week he came into office in 2001. So clearly, all those times that they were saying to us that, no, we're not going to go to war, Bush was lying. When he was saying, for example, when he was saying, I think I got it here, where'd it go?
Of course, I hadn't made up my mind we're going to war with Iraq.
Yeah, that one.
Well, you can do this peacefully. Don't get me wrong. And if the world were to collectively come together to do so and to put pressure on Saddam Hussein and convince him to disarm, it's a chance he may decide to do that. And war is not my first choice. It's my last choice.
And here, March 8th.
We're doing everything we can to avoid war in Iraq. But if Saddam Hussein does not disarm peacefully, he will be disarmed by force.
Now, Dave, you're a psychologist. He knew that that was a lie when he said it. Does that make him a sociopath?
I felt from the beginning the extremes of this character disorder is psychopathic in nature, certainly sociopathic. I would say that...
What if he's just greedy? I mean, you know, what if he's just power hungry? What if it's just garden variety, wants to be a big shot?
He has killed a lot of people to accomplish his goals. That is a crime. He has put our military at risk for whatever his profit motivations or his political motivations might be. Our military has been flamethrowing and shooting people all over Iraq. That's a crime.
Yeah. So you think he's over the edge. Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. 29 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
That And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change. Welcome back to our program. Texas public schools have had abstinence-only sex education since 1995, when then-Governor George W. Bush signed a law making Texas the third state to follow the curriculum. The abstinence-only initiative gained national attention in 1996 when Bill Clinton enacted landmark welfare reform that included grants for abstinence programs. And in November of 2004, Congress included more than $131 million for abstinence programs in a spending bill, an increase of $30 million, but about $100 million less than what President Bush wanted. The national evaluation of abstinence programs is supposed to happen, but it kind of keeps getting delayed. In the meantime, a program about this, a film about the abstinence programs, is called The Education of Shelby Knox. It was screened at Human Rights Watch International Film Festival last week on the 14th, the Tuesday the 14th, Friday the 17th, and Sunday the 19th, and will air tomorrow on public broadcasting stations across the United States. Check out your local listings for when it's going to play. It looks like it's going to be 10 p.m. Eastern time on most PBS stations. But the title, The Education of Shelby Knox, and Marion Lipschitz and Shelby Knox are with us. Hey, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Marion, and Shelby and I will trade back and forth the phone.
Okay. Marion, what's your role in all this?
I'm the producer-director with Rose Rosenblatt.
Oh, okay. And how did you get this movie put together? I mean, what brought this thing together for you?
Well, let's see. We were an issue in search of a story, and the issue is funding for abstinence until marriage sex education, and we needed a story on the ground, and that was happening in Lubbock, Texas. And once you talk to Shelby, you'll understand, I think, why we made a film about her.
Okay. Well, let's talk to Shelby then. Shelby, you are now a college student, and in fact, I have the school you're attending here. I don't have it any longer.
I'll be a junior.
Yeah, but you were a high school student when all this started, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And in Lubbock, Texas, and tell us what happened.
When I was in about ninth grade, I started realizing that a lot of my friends were getting pregnant, people were getting sexually transmitted infections, and they didn't really know who to talk to about sex or their own sexuality issues. And I realized that these problems were stemming from a lack of good sex education.
And so didn't your school have sex education programs?
Our school has an abstinence-only sex education program. Basically, the only sex ed you get is a pastor who comes into the schools a couple times and tells you that if you have sex before you're married, then you're going to hell and you're a bad person.
A pastor?
Yes, a pastor.
And this is funded with state money?
Well, actually now, because there was a concern about a lawsuit, the PTAs pay for the pastor to come in. But this is the only sex education that students receive.
So if a kid in a Texas school wants to learn about human sexuality, or even, you know, how our bodies work, they can't get that information. Is that what you're telling me?
You get basic anatomy, but you don't get the information on how you contract an STI or HIV. You don't get information on where to get tested, how to protect yourself from getting pregnant or getting a sexually transmitted infection. None of that information is available.
So the assumption here is that if we don't tell kids about how sex works, then they won't do it. And if we can scare the bejesus out of them, then they'll stay away from it. Yeah, you know, is that a fair summary of the theory behind the abstinence-only sex education?
I think it's a fair summary. However, it's not working. 60% of American high school students have sex before they graduate from high school, and 1 in 14 girls in Lubbock gets pregnant. So I really think that that tactic, no matter what the rationale behind it, is not working.
So it sounds like in Texas, where this abstinence-only sex ed is being practiced, you're actually having worse pregnancy rates and sexually transmitted disease rates than in states where they have full-blown sex ed, where they explain about the various diseases and what condoms are and what birth control is and what protects you from what and what doesn't protect you from what and that kind of thing?
That's 100% correct. I think that not talking about it, telling kids don't do this, you know, if you do, you're bad, but not telling them why, it makes them more curious, while giving them actual information gives them the responsible information to make good choices.
So, Shelby Knox, what happened to you when you started talking about this? You were a high school student, and you started speaking out, saying, "Hey, my friends are getting pregnant." Now, you had taken a virginity pledge, right, and said, you know, you weren't going to have sex, and this wasn't about, you know, you wanted to know how you could become promiscuous or something like that. But you were speaking out and saying, "Hey, your friends are becoming pregnant. People are getting diseases. What's going on?"
Yeah, I really just started talking about this and trying to make people aware. I also wanted to talk to the school board about the needs of the kids, and this is all outlined in the movie, but the school board wasn't really willing to listen to the students who they're in charge of educating.
At all?
No, not really at all. So we basically started talking to the media, started talking to the parents, and becoming peer educators to our contemporaries to really get the information out there that we need better sex ed.
And what happened when you did that?
I had a lot of support from my friends, from peers who realized that we needed good sex education. I had sort of a breaking with my church who did not feel like I should be doing that type of thing. And the schools, some teachers were quite unhappy. The school board was quite unhappy with me. And I think that they would have rather I stayed home and played video games or something.
Yeah. Well, and you're continuing to carry the message ultimately what we're talking about here is preventing sexually transmitted diseases and preventing unwanted pregnancies, right?
Right.
I guess by definition they would be unwanted. Shelby, congratulations. Shelby Knox, The Education of Shelby Knox. It'll be on, it's tomorrow night on PBS, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Check your local listing.
Great. Well, I salute you. You're doing great work and keep it up.
Thank you.
And thanks for being with us, and thanks to Marion also for producing a great movie. I do
Thank
appreciate
you.
It. It's Shelby Knox, The Education of Shelby Knox, Human Rights International, first screened at look for the PBS station near you. Should be interesting. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. We've been talking about a variety of things today, including and in particular how George W. Bush lied us into the war in Iraq. Scott in San Diego on the line, or back on the line. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Well, good morning, Tom. Can you hear me this time?
I certainly can.
Oh, good. We have actually got good weather down here now. It's actually San Diego weather.
Oh, that's
down
great.
Here in San Diego.
We had San Diego weather in Portland, Oregon yesterday. It was a beautiful day. So.
Oh, isn't that nice? It was gorgeous. Hey, listen, I was catching up on the stuff, you know, on all the shows over the weekend about what George Bush has been saying, and something really struck me, Tom. First of all, my mom is a clinical psychologist, nurse psychologist. My dad worked at the St. Vincent de Paul for years as a counselor for addicts. And as I was listening to these comments of what George Bush is saying and the replies like in the Laura Flanders show, it struck me. George, as we know, Jr., does not like his father and has a lot of animosity and anger towards him. And I know from my own studies that men who have problems with their fathers also have problems with authority, including law. They specifically have problems with following the laws
sure.
and feel that they're above it.
Yeah.
And it's just so clear that George Bush is doing exactly that. It's clear to me anyway.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. And he's not the first historical figure to have been in that situation, by the way.
Their situations resulted in similar actions like this one, denying the law, breaking laws, things like that?
Well, yeah, Adolf Hitler, his father beat him and then vanished when he was relatively young. He was very, very abusive and then left him and his mother, I mean, among others. It's but, you know, I'm very reluctant to make Hitler-Bush analogies just broadly because Bush hasn't killed 50 million people yet. But there are some, I suppose, some. Actually, I shouldn't be so reluctant to make those parallels if the Republicans are willing to. I mean, Grover Norquist has come out and called, or Tom DeLay came out and called the EPA Nazis. And Grover Norquist, talking about these things, it was using the Nazi word. He was in October of 2003. He was being interviewed on NPR, and he compared the estate tax to the Holocaust. And then on NPR, and then when he was asked, you know, did you really mean to say that? In a January 23rd interview in Forward magazine, and he said his statements were, quote, entirely reasonable, end quote. And then he even went on to compare Democrats to Nazis. He says, quote, the Nazis were for gun control. The Nazis were for high marginal tax rates. Do you want to talk about who's closer to National Socialism, the right or the left? And then he went on to say that he would not hesitate to make Holocaust comparisons in the future, end quote. So you know,
Tom, I heard your show this morning on your morning show. It was really great as you talked about the futility of some of the Democrats apologizing for what they're saying based upon what the right is saying about us. And I'm really curious, why? I didn't hear an answer to this during your show. Why do you think the Democrats will roll over like this and apologize when the Republicans are more than willing to take their hobnailed boots and run over us?
Because the press was not going to let up on Dick Durbin. And Dick Durbin got it that if he didn't say something, he was going to be dragged through the mud to the point where he was shredded and bleeding. Whereas when Grover Norquist says these kinds of things, when Tom DeLake says these kinds of things, you know, and on and on and on, as I had mentioned earlier, Phil Graham says these kind of things, James Inhofe says these kind of things, Senator Jeff Sessions says these kind of things, Tom Cole of Oklahoma says these kind of things, Peter King of New York says, you know, talks about Nazis, all of these guys talking about Nazis, the press doesn't say a thing because they're Republicans. I'm telling you, the press in this country, the mainstream media, is in part owned by Republicans, right? I mean, it's huge multinational corporations who are the handmaidens of the Republican Party or vice versa.
And there's only five corporations that actually own all news outlets, and I think I heard recently it's shrinking to three who will soon control all the news outlets and all the media outlets.
Well, it depends on how you define all, and it depends on which realm you're talking about. But, you know, the major
commercial media. NBC,
yeah,
CBS,
the definitive book on that is the Media Monopoly by Ben Bagdikian. And it's changed over time. I mean, you know, we went from 50 or 60 in the early 80s down to around 14 companies a couple of years ago, last I looked, who controlled, as I recall, 80 to 85% of the media. There's a chapter about this in my book on equal protection that lays out those numbers. But see, you've got to, like 14,000 magazines are basically under the control of four companies.
Earth being number one, I think, right?
I don't know. The newspapers in the United States, you know, a handful of companies, but I don't think we're down to three yet, but we're certainly down into two digits, in the low end of two digits. But the point is that on the one hand, you've got the media and the big multinational corporations being one and the same to a large extent in the United States. And also what has happened, and this, I think is the bigger issue. Because, for example, a lot of people listening to this program right now are listening on Clear Channel stations. You know, a big corporation, everybody likes to vilify it. It's a conservative company. The head of the company, contributes money to the Bush campaign and all. And I do a morning show on a Clear Channel station, and they're the largest distributor of Air America content. You know, but 80-90% of people in America who are listening to Air America are listening on a Clear Channel station.
And that surprises the heck out of me, Tom.
Well,
it really does.
What it proves is that it's about making money. That, you know, the definition of a capitalist ultimately is a person who will sell you the rope that you're going to use to hang him. And it's about making money. But here's that's why I don't buy the notion that the entire issue here is that the reporters are trying to go along with the company line. Now, we've seen that clearly at MSNBC. But beyond that, I'm with Phil Donahue and Chris Matthews and whatnot. You know, if you have one liberal on, you have to have two to three conservatives on, and you know, blah de blah. But I think the real thing is that news has gone from being news, like the old fashioned days when Walter Cronkite was earning, you know, $40,000, $50,000, $70,000 a year, maybe in his heyday. It's gone from being news where it was a money losing kind of poor stepsister, but it was
public
there
service.
It was there because it was necessary to fulfill the public service requirements of the FCC. And when Reagan stopped enforcing those things, and then when Clinton put the nail in the coffin with the Telecommunications Act in 95, when those things happened, then the news became part of the infotainment or entertainment industry, and the result of that is that now these guys, you know, with the blow-dried hairdos and the women with the cutesy whatever, that they are, and the White House reporters and whatnot, they're making $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, you know, a year, some of them making $1 million, some of them making $5, $10 million a year. We're talking serious money here. And these people know that their salary depends on their being able to ask a question of George Bush and have him take their question. They know that their salary depends on their being able to sit down with Tom DeLay and have him have a conversation with them. And if they tell the truth, they also know that Tom DeLay and Denny Hastert and George Bush and Dick Cheney will never speak to them. And so they're afraid.
They won't have a job because they won't have any contact.
That's right. That's right. So
the Buzzsaw talks about exactly this and how bad it's getting in the media and the pressures.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What you give up by not telling a story only to maintain your contact so you get another paycheck.
There you go. Scott, well said. And that's really the issue ultimately. Paul in New Mexico, Santa Fe on the line. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Tom. Yeah, I just wanted to make a little comment about the torture at Abu Ghraib and Gitmo, and then I'll get off. But a connection I just realized a week or two ago when they had the resolution in the Senate about condemning or apologizing for lynching.
Yeah.
I Googled and just read a lot of accounts of these lynchings, you know, which mostly they stopped in the 30s, but there were still some in the 50s and 60s. But basically, you know, before these blacks were lynched and hung, they were tortured often in very, I mean, just grisly ways.
Yes.
And these were big community celebrations. There'd be 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people witnessing this.
Yes.
And that's a part of the, you know, American history, which is, you know, we're just in big denial that this is a part of, you know, who we are, in effect. And it's never really.
And what boggles my mind is that the entire senatorial delegation from Texas refused to sign on to that thing. The entire senatorial delegation from Utah refused to sign on to that thing. And the entire senatorial delegation from Mississippi refused to sign on to the apology for lynching. These Republicans, all of the Republicans in the Senate from Mississippi, Texas, and Utah said, no, we're not going to sign that. Sorry.
Yeah.
We're not going to co-sponsor it. Excuse me.
Exactly.
We're not gonna...
And what I noticed, they had a chart of the most lynchings per state. The two states that had the most lynchings over the past 80 years were Texas and Mississippi.
Yeah. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
So, you know, what goes around comes around. Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to us there on KRSN in Los Alamos, New Mexico, getting into Santa Fe. It is 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman, and we collectively, together, you and I, we are moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. How do we do it? We get involved. Right now, we get politically involved. Wake up and participate.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you understand the thing I'm feeling today? The button's pushed, there's no one in the way. No one's safe with the world in the grave.
And welcome back, my friends. 4.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Viagra for your brain, the Tom Hartman Program. Gary in Joshua Tree, California on the line. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Well, hi, Tom. I was just thinking, if we put Abu Ghraib in historical perspective, during World War II, the Nazis, or the German army that held American and Allied prisoners, allowed the prisoners to write, accept mail, receive rations. I have the impression, I would have to do a lot of research on this, but I have the impression that the Germans allowed the Americans and the Allies to have glee clubs, to give lectures, to...
The Germans, by and large, were treating American prisoners under the Geneva Convention. Now, that, by the way, cannot be said of the way that the Germans treated all the Soviet prisoners. There were mass murders of Soviet prisoners of war by the Germans, particularly toward the end of the war. But they were very afraid of the Americans, and that's the whole point. One of the reasons why you want to conform to the Geneva Convention is so that your opponents will conform to the Geneva Convention, so that your soldiers, when they get captured, are not subject to torture and humiliation.
And a part of that is, I seem to recall history's first-person narrative accounts of enemy POWs talking about how they were convinced America had something special, was different, because we did not abuse the Japanese on the most part, and we definitely didn't abuse the German POWs we had here.
That's
in
right,
America.
And that was one of the reasons why those two countries, we were able to maintain intact relationships with those countries after we left. Thanks a lot for the call. Great point you made, Gary. Steve in Grand Rapids, what's up, Steve?
Hi, I am calling to ask two quick questions. One of them, have you seen on truthout.org this video of the speech given by William Rivers Pitt to Progressive Democrats of America?
I have not.
You might want to look at it.
Okay.
And secondly, I have read your articles on ADHD.
A little off topic. Okay.
And I was wondering how much of that applies to Asperger's as well.
Well, that's a good question. Asperger's, I think, is actually probably closer to part of the autistic spectrum, but there is some crossover there. If you want more information on Asperger's, in my opinion, the best book out there is Diagnosing Jefferson by Norm Legend. So it's a fascinating book, but you know, it's way off the topic of politics,
yeah.
And it's a very narrow discussion area. So I'm not going to go there much beyond that. Anyhow, I appreciate your call, Steve. Good to hear from you. And we've got to wrap it up for this hour. It's the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Bird flu on its way. I got to tell you about how George Bush is really, really putting us at risk in a little bit here.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Do we want corporations to be socially responsible entities? A good friend of mine, a fine progressive person who runs a progressive website, sent me an article over the weekend, and it really got me thinking about this. The article was from The Economist. And the Economist article basically was talking about how it's important that corporations now begin being socially responsible. They talked about CSR, corporate social responsibility, this movement for corporate social responsibility. In fact, the title of the article was The Biggest Contract, and the reference that it was making was to the social contract that Jean-Jacques Rousseau wrote about in the 1600s, the social contract between each other, amongst us, that is what we call society. Rousseau said, you know, there is a social contract, as much as libertarians would like to deny it. And this, of course, is the fatal flaw in the neoconservative and libertarian philosophy, political philosophy, where they suggest that every man is an island unto himself and none a part of the main, to paraphrase John Donne. And they're wrong. They're just simply wrong. There is a social contract. We have this thing called society. We interact with each other. There are certain rules by which society operates. Some of those rules we codify. Some of them we write down. Some of them we make into laws. Some of them we institute governments to promote. Others are simply, you know, the social construct, the social contract that doesn't need to be written down. You know, that people get ostracized if they violate that social contract. For example, how long do you maintain eye contact? How close do you stand to somebody when you're talking to them? Now, these are things, these you know, subtle dimensions of the social contract vary from society to society, but they're there and they're real nonetheless. Now, how do we protect our families? How do we participate? How do we interact with others? All of these are all parts of the social contract. And traditionally what we have done is we have said, okay, when we the people get together, and you know, whether it's in a family unit, whether it's in a tribe, whether it's in a clan, whether it's in a town, whether it's in a community, whatever it may be, when we the people get together, then we are doing it, to form some sort of social unit, some sort of coherent social unit, a town, a county, a state, a nation. We're doing that to protect ourselves from the crazies and predators among us and from those outside of us. We are entering into a social contract, a mutual defense contract, a mutual protection contract with each other. And that is how the founders of this country envisioned our government. That the government, that the opening words of the Constitution of the United States, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. And then they talk about, you know, the seven things, these things that really had never before been discussed in founding documents of nations. In order to establish a more perfect union. Perfect union? This is the social contract they were talking about, Rousseau's idea. Establish justice, not control. Not fear-based, justice. Ensure domestic tranquility. Now, they didn't mean by that have everybody terrified of the government. What they meant was to produce a government, to produce a nation where, you know, people are happy to live here. Provide for the common defense. Obviously, we want to collectively defend ourselves. Promote the general welfare. No government had ever before had that in its founding documents. What? We have, you know, it's we have something to do with the founding notions of most of the world's religions, that you know, we are our brother's keeper. That if there, you know, that a chain is only as strong as its weakest link, and that it's our obligation in society to strengthen the weakest links among us. To provide for those who might have fallen through the cracks of our society, of our social contract. And to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and to our posterity, to our children and great-grandchildren, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. There it is. Now, nowhere in there does it say, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, have decided that we're going to have corporations decide how clean our water should be, how pure our air should be, how safe our food should be, whether or not our drug supply is safe, what our working conditions are going to be. No, it doesn't say that. It doesn't say that corporations shall establish justice. It doesn't say that multinational corporations will be responsible for ensuring domestic tranquility. It doesn't talk about multinational corporations providing for the common defense. It doesn't talk about big corporations promoting the general welfare. And it doesn't talk about hiring multinational corporations to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. It doesn't. And this friend who sent me this article said, isn't this great? Here you have The Economist, you know, the big British publication, the British equivalent of Forbes or Fortune or Inc. magazine. I mean, we have no real equivalent, I suppose, of The Economist here in the United States. You know, the Wall Street Journal, I suppose, is the closest you can get to it. To have The Economist talking about it's time for CEOs of big companies, I'm quoting from The Economist, of big companies, to recast this debate and recapture the intellectual and moral high ground from their critics. They say, you know, Milton Friedman's old phrase, the business of business is business, that's not enough. That's not enough. Corporations have to get into the business of social responsibility. In fact, they quote Rousseau, the guy who started all this in the 1600s, who inspired the founders of this nation. And he, as the implicit social contract, and this... Now, and they point out there's examples abound of the long-term business impact of social issues. They're growing fast in the pharmaceutical sector. A storm of social pressures over the last decade, stemming from issues such as public perceptions of excessive prices charged for HIV drugs in developing countries, for example, are now translating into a general and sometimes seemingly indiscriminate toughening in the regulatory environment. Whoa. Do you get it now? What the Economist is suggesting here, and I'm telling you, this is that part of the show where I tell you in advance what's going to be happening. You're 6 months from now, you're going to be calling. You told us that would happen. Now I see. Companies are going to start getting green. Overtly, they're going to start getting energy conscious. They're going to start getting environmentally conscious. They're going to start talking about the importance of protecting the nation and the people. Why? So that you and I don't. This is not about corporations really and truly becoming appropriate in their behavior. Again, quoting The Economist, they're talking about the corporate social responsibility movement. Its popularity as a set of tactics among companies was driven in large part by a series of anti-corporate campaigns in the 1990s. And you're talking about big corporations. They have seen it as a means to avoid NGO and reputational flack. Non-governmental organization. In other words, they've seen it as a way to keep Greenpeace out of their front yard and to mitigate the rougher edges and consequences of capitalism. And they're just laying it right out. And what they're suggesting is, they wrap the article up, more than two centuries ago, Rousseau's social contract helped to seed the idea among political leaders that they must serve the public good, lest their own legitimacy be threatened. The CEOs of today's big corporations, that of course being the readers of The Economist, should take the opportunity to restate and reinforce their own social contracts in order to help secure. Now, at this point, do you think that they're going to talk about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? At this point, do you think that they're going to talk about establishing justice, ensuring domestic tranquility, providing for the common defense, promoting the general welfare, securing the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterities? No. They say the CEOs of today's big corporations should take the opportunity to restate and reinforce their own social contracts in order to help secure, for the long term, the invested billions of their shareholders. You get it? There is a movement afoot of large multinational corporations saying, don't worry, we'll take care of everything. We're here to help. Everything's going to be fine. Just stop trying to regulate us. Stop trying to control us. Stop trying, we the people, no more laws from we the people. And guess what? If they're successful, no more we the people. 1-866-889-8894, Victoria in San Diego, California. Hey, Victoria, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted you to know, yes, I am in San Diego, and our public broadcasting is KPBS. And they're showing the Shelby Knox Sing on Wednesday, 6:22 at 4 a.m. in the morning.
Oh, my goodness.
4 a.m. to 5.
It must be Ken Tomlinson got to them. This is liberal propaganda.
I just wanted you to know that.
That's absolutely incredible. Shelby, the education of Shelby Knox. Shelby was a guest on our program in the last hour, and this is the program about this young woman who stood up and said and pointed out that the emperor has no clothes. That the program that George Bush put into place as governor of Texas in 1995 of abstinence-only sex education in the schools not only is not working, but is causing the Texas schools to have among the highest rates of unwanted pregnancies and sexually transmitted diseases in the world, or in the nation, among the developed countries in the world. And
it's titled POV. P period, O period, V period. You have to bring up the description to even see that it's teenagers. It says, teenager Shelby Knox advocates sex education in high schools of her hometown, Lubbock, Texas.
Interesting. Amazing. Well,
4 a.m. Yes.
4 a.m. Well, you can... What can I say? We're looking at the end days, I fear, of public broadcasting. It's a tragedy and a loss to us all.
I know. You're going off to a break.
There
bye
you go.
Bye.
Victoria,
thanks
so much. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen.
Good day, and quite a bit going on. The president, as you probably heard, may appoint Bolton if he does not get the up and down vote, which is the cloture vote, which may happen as early as 5 p.m. this afternoon. And if he does not get the 60 votes necessary to put him to an up or down vote, then the president is thinking of doing a recess appointment. That would be all of this year and all of the next year till Congress comes back into session, which would be mid-January of 2007.
Wow. And the recess appointment clause was put into the Constitution originally to deal with emergencies. And this president has used it quite often. Past presidents have not, have they?
Well, I think actually Clinton did quite a few recess appointments.
Well, that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. But you know, he, of course, is he's using it as much as he possibly can. Also, today, Condoleezza Rice was at the American University in Cairo. She was speaking to about 700 members of various parts of the Egyptian government. She said she is making a case for the expansion of democracy. She said, listen to this one, the United States has pursued stability at the expense of democracy. It has achieved neither. The success of democracy depends on the public character and private virtue.
Hmm.
Are you still there?
I am. I am. I'm just.
It's pretty amazing.
You know, yeah, I'm a little.
I love the public character and private virtue.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's rhetoric, really, ultimately, when you get right down to it. They're doing anything they can to avoid discussing the fact that George Bush lied us into this war for political gain, pure and simple. I hope you have an opportunity to read the piece I put on Common Dreams today.
I will do so. I have a piece on WorldNet Daily today, so we'll read each other's pieces.
Oh, okay.
Great. Also, Gingrich is now going after Durbin. Of course, Gingrich wants to run for president. About what he said about the Guantanamo, he said, by his statements equating American treatment of suspected terrorists at Guantanamo Bay with the behavior of evil regimes of Nazi Germany, Soviet Union, Pol Pot, he has dishonored the United States and the entire Senate. He is calling, as I said, for him to be censured.
Why doesn't he talk about James Inhofe, the Republican from Oklahoma, characterizing the EPA as the Gestapo bureaucracy, or Tom DeLay calling the EPA the Gestapo, or Jeff Sessions, Republican from Alabama, talking about people who do stem cell work as the same thing as Nazi German scientists, or Phil Graham from Texas saying that when Clinton was trying to raise taxes on the millionaires and billionaires to balance the budget, he said, now forgive me, but that is right out of Nazi Germany. I don't understand why all of a sudden we're passing laws that are right out of Nazi Germany. Or Tom Cole, the Republican from Oklahoma, last March saying that if you voted against Bush, that was the same thing as supporting Hitler during World War II. How come, Peter King saying that that abortion is the same thing as a Nazi prison guard saying I was just following orders, saying, you know, that the doctors who perform abortions. Why aren't any of these guys being held to account?
Exactly.
Well,
exactly. Was that in your piece today?
No. Media Matters for America is doing that. But my piece is about why Bush lied us into this war. But the point is, my answer to that question, why none of these guys are being held to account, is that the media doesn't hold these guys. The media, when Republicans make outrageous statements,
they're allowed a free pass.
That's right. And when Democrats make outrageous statements, the media goes after them mercilessly. And this is the so-called liberal media?
Well, that's right. There is no liberal media.
I mean, here's Grover Norquist, quote, the Nazis were for gun control. The Nazis were for high marginal tax rates. Do you want to talk about who's closer to National Socialism, the right or the left? You know, come on. He says he compared the estate tax to the Holocaust. And then when afterwards they said, do you really mean to compare the estate tax to the Holocaust? He said, quote, my statements were entirely reasonable, end quote. And then tried to compare Democrats to Nazis.
Give me a break.
I mean, this is Grover Norquist. And they want to talk about Dick Durbin. And I thought what Dick Durbin said was right. I thought he was...
I agree, and I defended him on Fox News Channel the other day.
I'm amazed that he backed down. I am just amazed. I wish he had stood up. But you can understand the absolute beating that these guys take in the media, if they're Democrats, not if they're Republicans. Thanks a lot, Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Richard Clark, in his book Against All Enemies, this is from a piece on TomPaine.com today, by the way, by Russ Baker, Why George Went to War, TomPaine.com. He's quoting from Richard Clark's book Against All Enemies on September 12th. This is the day after 9/11, right? Quoting Richard Clark, the White House counterterrorism coordinator. Quote, on September 12th, I left the video conference center, and there, wandering alone around the Situation Room, was the president. He looked like he wanted something to do. He grabbed a few of us and closed the door to the conference room. Look, he told us, I know you all have a lot to do, but I want you, as soon as you can, to go back over everything. See if Saddam did this. See if he's linked in any way. I was once again taken aback, incredulous, and it showed. But, Mr. President, Al-Qaeda did this. I know, but see if Saddam was involved. Just look. I want to know any shred. Look into Iraq, Saddam, the president said testily as he left us. Lisa Gordon Haggerty stared after him with her mouth hanging open. Similarly, Bob Woodward, in a CBS 60 Minutes interview about his book Bush at War, talks about the same, more or less, time period, November 21st, 2001. That's now 3 weeks after 9/11. 2.5 weeks. Quote, this is Bob Woodward. He's talking to Mike Wallace. Bob Woodward says, President Bush, after a National Security Council meeting, takes Don Rumsfeld aside, collars him physically, and takes him into a little cubbyhole room and closes the door and says, what have you got in terms of plans for Iraq? What's the status of the war plan? I want you to get on it. I want you to keep it secret. Woodward says immediately after that, Rumsfeld told General Tommy Franks to develop a war plan to invade Iraq and remove Saddam, and that Rumsfeld gives Franks a blank check. This is Mike Wallace, that's his voiceover. And then Woodward's voice again. Rumsfeld and Franks work out a deal essentially where Franks can spend any money he needs. And so he starts building runways and pipelines and doing all the necessary preparations in Kuwait specifically to make war possible. Bush wanted a war so he could build the political capital necessary to achieve his domestic agenda and become, in his mind, a great president, writes Russ Baker. Blair and the members of his cabinet, unaware of the Herskovitz conversations, placed Bush's decision to mount an invasion in or about July of 2002. But for Bush, the question that summer was not whether, it was only how and when. The most important question, why, was left for later. He says, eventually there will be a succession of answers to that question. Weapons of mass destruction, links to Al-Qaeda, the promotion of democracy, the domino theory of the Middle East. But none of them have been as convincing as the reason George W. Bush gave way back in the summer of 1999. What did he say in the summer of 1999? This is when he was talking with Mickey Herskovitz. Mickey Herskovitz, the guy who the Bush family hired to write a book called A Charge to Keep, The Autobiography of George W. Bush. Mickey Herskovitz conducted some 20 interviews with George W. Bush and ultimately didn't finish the book. Another ghostwriter was brought in to finish the book. But Herskovitz was interviewing and spending time with George W. Bush in 1999, and he spoke with Russ Baker. And this is what he told Russ Baker. He said, quote, he was thinking about invading Iraq in 1999. It was on his mind. He said, one of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as a commander-in-chief. And he said, my father had all his political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait and he wasted it. And he said, if I had have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency. George W. Bush. 1999. If I have a chance to invade Iraq, if I have that much political capital, I'm not going to waste it like my father did. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed. I'm going to have a successful presidency. He points out how Bush, many of the Republicans, they watched, you know, Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher went over and trounced Argentina. Remember that, the Falkland Islands? Hey, you get this little island off the coast of Argentina that the British and the Argentines have been fighting over, shall we say, for decades. Perhaps longer, frankly. And Margaret Thatcher finally says, okay, that's it. We're taking them. And she sends the British fleet over, and they kick the butt of the Argentinians, kick them out of the area, and they take back the Falkland Islands. And you know, it's an island. It's got a bunch of birds on it. It has no strategic value. It has no significance. You know, it was nothing more than a way for Margaret Thatcher to increase her political capital, quite simply, to increase her political power at home, so that she could then push through her conservative agenda of privatizing the railroads, privatizing the air traffic control system, turning everything over to her corporate masters. Very simple. And the Bushies were just, wow, look at that. Because they, you know, it was a quick war. They quickly beat the Argentinians, and then they come home, and the fleet, and everybody's at the docks, and they're waving their flags, and people are crying, and they're throwing rose petals, and Margaret Thatcher's meeting with the Queen, and Bush is going, yeah, that's what I want, a quick war. And he's looking at Iraq, and he's going, eh, that Saddam guy, you know, he doesn't have any weapons. We know Scott Ritter told us he's completely disarmed. Bill Clinton basically bombed him into smithereens. His Air Force, shredded the thing for 8 years. There's nothing left there. He's got a bunch of 15-year-olds in second- and third-hand uniforms as his army, and they're just doing it because there's nothing, you know, there's no other work, or because they got drafted and they had no choice. So how about a little war in Iraq? That would be nice. You know, Reagan did the same thing in Grenada. You get a little bad news. Hey, word's starting to come out about Iran-Contra. Let's invade Grenada. That'll change the topic. And nothing like a good little war to make people feel good about you and think you're a marvelous president. Commander-in-chief, that always sells well. Wear that, you know, bomber jacket or, you know, land on an aircraft carrier deck. And now we discover that George W. Bush, was lying to us. Back in 2002, in October, on October 1st of 2002, when he said,
of course, I hadn't made up my mind, we're going to war with Iraq.
We know now that he was lying to us. Now, we thought that the reason that we were going to war was what Cheney said.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia.
And in fact, our belief in that was reinforced when
your
Bush...
Your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
When Bush said that...
Your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
Right. When he was speaking, you know, as he was announcing the war, we had assumed that that was the case. And then, of course, Bush tried to reinvent history. After the fact, you will recall there were weapons inspectors in Iraq. Remember Hans Blix and Mohammed El-Baradei? And their job was to look for nuclear weapons in the case of El-Baradei, and for chemical and biological weapons in the case, and conventional weapons in the case of Hans Blix. And they were looking all over the country. They couldn't find anything. But they said, if you just give us a couple more weeks, Hans Blix said, somewhere between 2 and 6 weeks, we will know for sure, because we will have looked in every nook and cranny of this entire country. We will know for sure whether there's anything here. And Bush and the UN said, fine. Resolution 1440 says that no nation can commence hostilities against Iraq until Hans Blix and or Mohammed El-Baradei say that they have weapons of mass destruction and thus are in breach of the UN resolutions that, you know, originally caused, you know, said that they had to disarm. 1441 was a, you know, follow-up to that. But George Bush then said, as the inspectors were saying, you know, it doesn't look like there's anything here. Nothing here. Nothing here. We can't find anything. Don Rumsfeld comes out, oh, we know where it is. It's just northwest of Baghdad. They said, cool, tell us. Give us the satellite coordinates. We'll find it for you. We'll help you make your case. We don't have those coordinates. That's top secret. No, sorry. We can't share that with the UN. It's not secure. And so we were just a few weeks away. The world was a few weeks away, and every country in the world knew it, was just a few weeks away from knowing for certain that Saddam Hussein represented no threat to anybody except his own people. And he represented less of a threat to his own people than most of the dictators in the world do to their own people. This is not to make Saddam into any kind of saint. The guy was an evil SOB, period. But at least in his country, women could drive and didn't have to wear veils like they do in Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, every Friday, they have the public beheadings. Saddam had gotten beyond that. Oh, you know, he was doing private. Okay, enough about that. But anyhow, the point is that the weapons inspectors were just weeks away. Just weeks away. From saying, okay, that's it. We figured it out. There's nothing here. And Bush knew that. And then he would have no excuse for a war. None. So he pulled out the weapons inspectors. He said, we're going to go in. You guys have to come out. Saddam was saying, no, no, leave him here. Listen, I'll give him a guided tour. I'll show him around the country. Here, 14,000 pages of documents. Here's the proof. We've destroyed everything. There's nothing left. You can go anywhere in our country. Hey, you want oil? We'll sell you oil. That idea we had about denominating it in euros, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to keep it in dollars. You want to interrogate our people? Send the FBI over. And then Bush comes along after the war and tries to reinvent history. Talk about bald-faced lies.
Subsequent to the peace speech, the CIA had some doubts. But when I gave the, when they talked about the speech, when they looked at the speech, it was cleared. Otherwise, I wouldn't have put it in the speech.
Now, there he was speaking, of course, of the uranium in Niger. Anyhow, he continues.
I'm not interested in talking about intelligence unless it's cleared by the CIA. And, as Director Tenet said, it was cleared by the CIA. The larger point is...
And now here we get into the serious lie. Here it is. And you know, could he possibly be deluding himself?
The fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in. And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power along with other nations so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
Now, how is it possible that a lie of that proportion can go unchallenged? I'm just boggled by it. How is it possible that a lie like that, just an open, bald-faced lie, where he just comes right out and says, after he's the guy who pulled the weapons inspectors out, he comes out and says, and Saddam wouldn't let the weapons inspectors in, and therefore we had to go in and take him out. How is it that that has not been challenged? Nobody in the press corps stood up and said, excuse me, Mr. President, that's not what happened.
The question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in. And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power along with other nations so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
A threat to the United States? Well, sometimes, you know, up is down and left is right in George Bush's world.
That when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
Yeah. It's right out of 1984, isn't it? George Orwell. But anyhow, so now we discover George W. Bush was lying when he said...
Hopefully we can do this peacefully. Don't get me wrong. And if the world were to collectively come together to do so and to put pressure on Saddam Hussein and convince him to disarm... It's a chance he may decide to do that. And war is not my first choice. It's my last choice.
Turns out that was a lie.
And I made up her mind about military action. Hopefully this can be done peacefully.
And that was a lie.
Should Saddam Hussein choose confrontation, the American people can know that every measure,
has been taken to avoid war, and every measure will be taken to win it.
March 17th, 2003, another lie. This is from March 8th, 2003.
We're doing everything we can to avoid war in Iraq. But if Saddam Hussein does not disarm peacefully, he will be disarmed by force.
And he turns out George Bush was just so, he wanted this war so bad.
This is our attempt to work with the world community to create peace. And the best way for peace is for Mr. Saddam Hussein to disarm. It's up to him to make his decision.
And he did. And he disarmed. Because the last thing that dictators want is for some big country, for the most powerful country in the world, to come in and kick them out of their comfortable little throne. Well, I think we can all agree that Saddam Hussein was not a good guy. I don't think that we can all agree that Iraq is better off without him at the moment. But hopefully over the long term, they will be. Hopefully over the long term, they will be. I mean, I really and truly hope for the best in that situation. And to make that happen, we need to get out. Because we have become the irritant. We have become the problem in the area. We're the occupiers now. Just like when we occupied the Dominican Republic back in 1965, LBJ sends the Marines in. And, you know, within 6 months, we'd had almost 50 of our soldiers killed. Why? Because we were viewed as occupiers. We put down the communist insurgency. Remember that? It was long ago. So we got out, and they stopped shooting at us. It's real simple. It's real simple. We discovered this in Vietnam as well. 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
We're so rich that it's saving billionaires for Bush and Cheney. We can give you the stars and the moon.
Oh, it's the billionaires for Bush.
And we pay campaign debts. It's a way to hedge our bets that the winner will dance to our tune.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Ed in San Juan Capistrano on the telephone. Hey, Ed.
Hey, Tom. If you play back that thing again, that little thing there where he says we decided to take him out along with other nations,
right?
You can take that two ways. And there was another guy who says in June or July that we're going to invade Syria.
Oh, that's
interesting. And I think you've got another memo that says it right there. We decided to take him out with other nations, Tom.
In other words, you think that he's saying
he decided to take him out, and there's Iran and Syria.
Yeah, interesting. Well, here's the clip.
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in. And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power along with other nations so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
Wow. Well,
he does say it, doesn't he?
Yeah, but I really, you know,
yeah,
I know it's like, against my nature, but I'll give Bush the benefit of the doubt here. I think he means that we didn't do this unilaterally. We did it with other nations. You're not quite so charitable.
It's harder to keep a lie in than it is to just, you know, start spreading it.
Yeah.
And he said it in the Downing Street memo, says he meant it, and he meant what he said there.
Well, now, okay, specifically with regard to the Downing Street memo, where in the Downing Street, first of all, are you talking about the Downing Street minutes, the first one?
Minutes.
Or the memo, the later ones that all the right-wing websites and Rush Limbaugh and everybody right now are screaming are actually, you know, forgeries, and that it's CBS Dan Rather all over again.
It's hard for me to keep up with what minutes, memos, whatever it is.
Right.
But they did say it. They knew what they were doing, and I think they have a further agenda. Watch out for June or July. We're liable to have another building.
Yeah, well, that, you know, yeah, the God forbid. This is the point that I made in my Common Dreams article, that the conservatives know also that if Bush that this is an impeachable offense, going to war purely for political purposes. And that if Bush gets outed on this in a serious way, then his only option is going to be to have another war or for there to be another invasion or disaster here in the United States. And, you know, God forbid, we don't want either one of these happen. Ed, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. We've got to wrap up the day. Thanks for being with us today, and we will see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Do well. Be good. Keep the faith and spread the word, my friends. There, we really and truly are the majority. We, the people of the United States. Majority anyway in this country.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.